This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In spite of his self-destructive instincts, alto saxophonist Art Pepper managed to leave behind an impressive body of recordings before he died of a stroke at the age of 56 in 1982. He started his career playing with Stan Kenton and Shorty Rogers. In 1950, he became addicted to heroin. 3 years later, he was imprisoned on a narcotics charge. He spent the better part of the next 13 years in prison, 5 of those years in San Quentin. In the late 60s, while he was in rehab at Synanon, he met a woman, also in recovery, who became his wife. Lori Pepper helped him resume his career and co-wrote his acclaimed autobiography, Straight Life. Now she's helping to reissue his recordings. The latest is a box set called the Hollywood All-Star Sessions. Before we ask Lori Pepper to talk about her late husband's life, let's listen to a track from the new box set. This is a 1980 recording of You Go to My Head, featuring Pete Jolly on piano, Bob Magnuson bass, Roy McCurdy drums. Lori Pepper helped Art Pepper reestablish his music career after he got out of rehab. I asked her some of the obstacles she faced in convincing clubs, booking agents, and record producers to take a chance and work with him.
This is interesting because when we moved in together after Synanon, we did it because we wanted to be together and because I wanted to work on the book, Straight Life, and I had no ambitions for him musically. And he, because he had none, or he seemed to have none. He was working as a bookkeeper at that time. And he thought that getting back into music would destroy him. And he was also very frightened of having to prove himself again. My God, I mean, the amount of energy and passion that he put into that, that ambition took out of him was, you know, it was pretty formidable. So he gave me the impression that he didn't want to play music anymore. And so a friend of his got some jobs for him doing bar mitzvahs and weddings, you know, and he was making his living doing that. And then somebody got him a job doing a clinic, a saxophone clinic at a college, or I think it was a clarinet clinic, the first one. And there was never any idea that he would be a musician again, touring. So that did not come from me. And it didn't come from him either. It came from outside.
Did you get advice from other women who were married to jazz musicians and who were managing or helping to manage their husbands' careers?
Yeah, and that happened around the Vanguard date, too. At that time, I didn't see. When we went on that tour and went to the Vanguard, I didn't know that that was going to be my role. I really didn't see myself as his manager or anything. I was just going along. And then I met Keiko Jones, Elvin Jones' wife. And during this horrendous experience, every evening, Keiko would lecture me about what to do, what to wear, how to act. And as I said in my afterword to Straight Life, how much power to take. And she said, all of it, all of it. And she was one tough lady. She used to set up Elvin's drums for him and order him around, this big, frightening guy. I mean, it was really something. So I learned a lot from Keiko. Also, Phil Wood's partner, Jill Goodwin, she came over to our house, and we talked for a while, and she was wonderful. She was telling me more of the practical aspects of managing. So I began to realize that that was going to be my job.
What did Keiko Jones tell you about what to wear?
Well, at that time, I was wearing jeans. I was wearing jeans and T-shirts. That's all I ever wore. And she told me I had to dress better. I had to look prosperous, and I had to look elegant. Well, that didn't bother me at all. And in a short time, I went out and bought a lot of expensive clothes. That was no problem for me.
And for whose sake should you have looked prosperous and elegant?
Oh, well, for art, you know, so that that people would recognize that he was important and that he made a lot of money and he had status and they would pay us a lot of money. And, you know, I think she was right.
Was it ever hard for you, as a woman married to a jazz musician, to get respect from other musicians or from club owners or whatever? Were you treated as an individual or as the wife?
Great question. I love that question. Nobody's ever asked me that question. Yes, it was horrible. Not always. Sometimes it was just great and people treated me great. But there were other occasions where I would have to say, Art, will you come and tell this person that they have to listen to me, that I am speaking for you? And so he would. In Japan especially, you know, I mean, in Japan, women are really invisible and beside the point. And so because I was in charge of the sound for the band, you know, and I was in charge of the sound guy in the various venues we went to when I learned the Japanese words for louder and softer and stuff like that, I mean, these guys would ignore me utterly. And some of them were kids, you know, a great deal younger than me. But I had to take Art by the hand with an interpreter, and he had to say, she is speaking for me. And it sometimes was rough. The other part that was rough was that Art would complain to me about things where he didn't like confrontations and he didn't like to complain. So I had to be the bad guy. So he would complain about something. For instance, he hated drummers to do double time during a ballad, but he wouldn't tell them that. I had to tell them that. And if I didn't tell them that, then they would play double time during a ballad. And if I did, they wouldn't believe me. So it was kind of, you know, it was, yes.
So that put you in the position sometimes, too, probably, of looking like the nag.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. I think I got kind of famous as being a real, you know, tiresome bitch. But, you know, I kind of liked it. All my life I'd been so nice.
Would he ask you about tunes that should be in his repertoire or get your impressions of his playing?
Yeah. He, poor guy, he did, and I told him. Generally, I would be the one who would compile the list of tunes for an individual set. He was usually too nervous beforehand to compile a good list. And what I would see him do is go out and play a whole bunch of tunes that were all pretty much the same kind of tune. And he agreed that there should be a variation. In fact, maybe it was even Keiko that told me that. I don't know. At any rate, so I began to be the one. I would give him a list of tunes. And he would show it to the guys, and that would be it. So he would do that. There were times when I would suggest that it would be wonderful if he would play a given tune. I would bring things home and play them for him. You know, yeah, there was a lot of that. That's part of what I was also talking about the respect that he gave me. You know, the fact that he would discuss these things with me as if I knew what I was talking about. It's pretty nice.
My guest is Lori Pepper. She's helping to reissue the recordings of her late husband, alto saxophonist Art Pepper. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Lori Pepper, we're talking about her late husband, alto saxophonist Art Pepper. Many of his recordings are getting reissued. This is from the reissue of his 1957 album, Art Pepper Meets the Rhythm Section. Thank you. like traveling with him, whether it was New York to play at the Vanguard or Tokyo to play concerts there. He was on methadone maintenance, and he was using other drugs as well. So what was it like when you were on the road?
Hell. It was like hell. When we traveled in Japan, I had to hide the methadone because no matter what, the fact that it was a prescription item for him didn't matter. They wouldn't let it into the country.
Methadone was illegal there?
Totally. Totally. We had a thing from the head of the Veterans Administration Hospital, and we were told, won't do you any good in Japan. You can't bring it in. So we had to hide it. I hid it in a shampoo bottle. Every time we went through any kind of checkout in any airport, and there were a lot of airports, I was shaking in my shoes that they would find it. In addition, I had to constantly monitor Art's use of it because if he could, he would take more than what he was supposed to. And I generally would have to hide it or lock it up or whatever. I've talked to women, lots of women who have been involved with men who are alcoholic or whatever, and I don't think I would have stuck it without that gift. The gift was there were a few things. The gift was one of them. The other thing was the way he treated me, which was very well. I mean, he gave me so much respect. He never criticized me. He thought I was terrific. He told everybody I was great. He wanted to believe that I was everything that he needed and told me that I was and told everybody else that I was, and so I did it. And that was a great learning experience for me, too, to find out what my capacities were.
There's one point in one of the sessions where he mentions you. This is an introduction.
Oh, that's not too nice. Yeah,
no, right. It's not. In fact, why don't I just play it here?
All right.
My last album, I was lucky enough to have recorded it with Elvin on drums and George Cables on piano and David Williams on bass, called Art Pepper the Trip on contemporary. And the record before that was called Art Pepper Living Legend with the late Hampton Hawes on piano, Charlie Hayden on bass, and Shelly Mann on drums. They're both for sale in the back by my wife. Wave your hand, baby. That pretty little, sweet little Jewish freak right there. That's my seventh woman. If I lose her, I'll go get an eighth. But I hope she don't leave me because I need her. Thank you. See you later.
That remark, which really was, that's about as low as he ever got. And the reason was this. He had been using the money. This was before I took control of the money, actually. He had been using the money that we had gotten to pay off a counselor at the methadone program in New York to buy extra methadone instead of using it to pay our hotel bill. I grabbed the money and paid the hotel bill with it. He was furious. I also said I was going to get that counselor in trouble. So he was very, very angry at me that night. But that's about as bad as it ever got. Usually, if you heard his comments on stage, he was lovely. He was lovely.
I'd like to play some more music from the Vanguard sessions that have just been released. And he plays Cherokee twice. Mm-hmm. On this, the first time he plays it, he talks about how, you know, no jazz musician is worth anything if they can't play the heck out of this tune.
Mm-hmm.
And then he proceeds to burn through it.
Right.
We're going to hear the second version that he plays. What were your impressions of this performance?
When I realized that he was going to play Cherokee on that particular night where he was just so totally dissipated, I couldn't believe his nerve.
Because he takes it at such a fast pace?
Well, he always took it at a fast pace. I knew what he was going to do if he played Cherokee. And the idea that he believed that he could do that, that he could pull it off, there was no risk he would not take on stage. He was amazing. So my state was, he can't do it, number one. And number two, what nerve. What nerve. And then when I heard it, my God, he's doing it. He was a hell of a ride, you know. ¶¶
That's Art Pepper. My guest is Lori Pepper. Art Pepper's health was not good in the last years of his life.
No, it wasn't.
Was there a point where he assumed that he wouldn't live much longer?
I think he assumed he wouldn't live much longer when he was 10 years old, to tell you the truth. When I met him, he told me he wasn't going to live much longer. When I met him in Synanon, I mean, I think that that was a refrain. I think he thought he had a limited time. And when he turned 50, I think he was utterly amazed. He was dumbfounded that he was still alive. He just could not believe it. So he thought that death was imminent. And when we began working on Straight Life, one of the first things he said is, I want to get this done because I know I'm dying. And yet he had 10 more years at that time.
Do you think that sense that, hey, I'm gonna die real soon, is mm-hmm. one of the reasons why he kept going back to drugs? Because he just didn't think it would matter in the long run, because he didn't think there'd be an in the long run?
Yeah, I think that was, at least it was a good rationalization for him, that mm-hmm. why shouldn't he get high? He didn't have that much longer. He should live the way he wanted to. And he had a lot of rationalizations for using drugs. But I think, you know, and the more I think about it, the more it seems to me to be the truth that Art was so profoundly troubled emotionally, and whatever they're learning these days about brain chemistry or whatever, he was such a troubled soul, and he suffered so. He was so unbelievably sensitive to the stuff that most of us can deal with, that I think he was self-medicating all his life. I think he was just trying to ease the pain, and because things were more real to him than they are to the rest of us. Things were so intense to him. And so he had a lot of rationalizations, but I think in the long run, it was the only way he could live.
Did he die in a lot of pain?
No. No, he didn't. He died insofar as it's possible to know you're dying and have it be an easy death. He died with very little pain. He had a cerebral hemorrhage. We didn't know it. He had a headache. And he never, never had headaches. I get migraines, but he never had headaches. And so I took him to the doctor. And it happened very quickly after that. But he knew he was dying. He told me in the car as I was driving him to the hospital. And he said he wanted me to know that he'd had a good life. And he wanted to thank me for what I had done. He felt that he'd done everything that he had to do. I told you that when the odds were against him, he rose to the occasion. And I can't think of any more difficult occasion than your own death. He was beautiful. You know, he was amazing, amazingly courageous. And he said all these things. And then we were in the hospital, and he was lying there on the table, and his entire left side became paralyzed. And he told me, you don't know how scared I am. And I just started hugging him and kissing him. And he said, that's what I need. I need love. And he was, you know, he did the hardest things so well. And he died well. And but he knew he was dying for so long. It was not a surprise. It was what he'd been waiting for.
Did you have a sense that he really wanted his music to live on after his death? That what happened to his music after his death was very important?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, there's this great... I was listening to some tape, live performance of his at some nightclub, and he gave this fantastic performance of something, and the audience was just screaming and yelling. And Art said into the microphone, he said, that just goes to show, you know. He said, that goes to show that you can cheat death. You can cheat death. And I just shivered when I heard that, because that's what he was up to.
Lori Pepper, recorded in 1996. She's just produced a box set of her late husband's recordings called Art Pepper, The Hollywood All-Star Sessions. This is Fresh Air.